Our second case for this morning is Charleston against Board of Trustees of the University of Illinois at Chicago, or maybe just the University of Illinois. Mr. Bach. You may proceed.
If it may please the Court, I'm Jason Bach on behalf of the appellant in this case, Mr. Charleston. This is essentially a case where a fourth-year medical student was dismissed or expelled from medical school for misconduct, for behavioral misconduct, without being afforded a hearing, a chance to respond to a number of pieces of key evidence that was used against him.
So, Mr. Bach, I'm sure that was terribly frustrating and bad for Mr. Charleston, but I don't understand how you can get around this court's statement in the Bisasur case that a graduate student does not have a federal constitutional right to a continued graduate education. This is not Goss against Lopez. So what do you have to say about that? That's from the procedural. That's a due process point. Doesn't get to equal protection.
The main difference between those line of cases and this particular situation is that those cases are addressing academic misconduct, whereas the Goss case and the Horowitz case address behavioral misconduct.
Well, what's plagiarism? That seems like academic misconduct and failure to turn reports in a timely way and so on.
In fact, I misspoke. Those line of cases deal with academic issues as opposed to academic misconduct. Academic misconduct or misconduct of any kind is dealt with as a behavioral issue, something that someone did wrong, as opposed to someone who simply got an F, fell below the minimum grade point average, and as a result, they're dismissed.
But the language of Bisasur is broader than that. It looks at whether, in a sense, the right forum for the kind of injury Mr. Charleston incurred is a federal court under federal constitutional grounds. Is there a liberty interest? Is there some kind of property interest in a continued graduate education? If the answer to that is yes, then 1983 is there if it's a state institution. If the answer to that is no, then whatever remedy he may have lies elsewhere.
Exactly. And that's, and also in Williams versus Wedler, that's what this court said as well. And where that property interest lies is in the agreements, in the contracts that he has with the institution.
Well, and so that's a different theory than just an interest in a continued graduate education. But I don't, and of course, a contract-based theory would be available to you since the district court dismissed the supplemental claims without prejudice. So presumably they could be pursued in a state court.
Sure. But as far as the 1983 claims, we still believe that those are valid because of the contractual property interest that he has, not just in enrolling in the institution and agreeing to their terms of enrollment and agreeing to their disciplinary policies that they have that they didn't abide by in this particular situation, but also in the agreement that he reached with the school, where even though he didn't agree with their initial decision that he had to repeat the rotation and had to have a mentor, while he didn't agree with that, while he didn't necessarily agree to the facts that led to that, he ultimately agreed that that would be his sanction. However,
so is it your theory then that every single breach of contract case that is now pending before the Circuit Court of Cook County could simply be refiled over in the district court here as a deprivation of a property interest? And if that's not your theory, then where do you draw the line?
Well, I think that what the Supreme Court has said, where you draw the line, is in Goss, when they talk about...
No, tell me about contract rights. We have everything from U.S. trust to other cases. When are contracts the kind of thing that can give rise to a constitutionally protected property right?
Well, when you have a government entity that has the authority to make those decisions,
so all contracts with the government are automatically 1983 cases?
No, I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to say that all contracts.
Which ones aren't?
Because we have case law here that says that when you take away that property interest that a student has, that could rise to a level of a due process violation. And in this particular situation, where we have a fourth-year medical student who is now being sabotaged by one doctor submitting a letter from 3 years ago saying that he did something wrong, which he was never even on notice for. I mean, there's absolutely no notice here, no opportunity to respond. After he had already reached this agreement that he was going to accept the sanction of repeating the rotation and having a mentor, suddenly...
Well, I understand that your theory focuses very much on the Hall letter, that it's not really about the earlier round of problems in the OBGYN rotation, but again, the problem I have with either, well, I have a big problem with your substantive due process argument, because that's just, we've been told not to go around creating substantive due process interests. Your procedural due process argument, I think, stumbles, or at least it's got to overcome this idea that you don't have a property interest or a liberty interest in your continued graduate education. So you're kind of backtracking to contract. You do have an equal protection class of one claim, but there I don't see any pleading about why Hall might have had some terrible animus against Mr. Charleston. Right. I don't see that either.
Apparently where the personal animus comes from is Mr. Charleston was a teaching assistant under Dr. Hall. Apparently they had a falling out. Mr. Charleston asked to go and be a teaching assistant or work somewhere else, and apparently there was a disagreement between the two back in 2008, I believe.
But that's not pleaded. I mean, we have Twombly and Iqbal. I don't see any hint of that, even in your requests to amend.
Right, and that was something that came to light further on down the road after that had been briefed at the district court level. However, I do believe it would have been that the district court could have seen that there was a plausible explanation that could have been added into an amended complaint to raise that issue if the court so desired to have that specifically.
But your request for leave to amend didn't explain that, did it?
No, it didn't explain that because
it
wasn't.
Did it explain how an amendment would improve what had been filed previously?
No, because at that point we were unaware of what the district court would find was lacking in the complaint. However, if the district court believed that there was not enough specificity as to the personal animus that took place, that was something that we felt that we could have added in, had we been given the opportunity to do so.
So when facing a 12B6 motion, a plaintiff needs to just throw in that line, by the way, if I lose, I'd like to amend my complaint, and that's sufficient for Rule 15?
I think it just depends on what the factual scenarios are. I mean, there are many times when amending the complaint isn't going to help. However, if there's a fact such as that that the district court believed is lacking and is required under 8A, that would be something that I would think would be easily remedied.
How would the district judge have known that from the 12B6 process about this animus between Hall and Charleston?
Well, they wouldn't have known that. However, I believe what the standard is whether or not there is a reasonable opportunity that a plaintiff would be able to allege facts that would be sufficient under 8A. And I would like to reserve 1 minute.
You may do that. So we will hear next from Mr. Jettolo.
Good morning, Your Honors. Norman Jedlow on behalf of the University Defendants. May it please the Court. I think as the questioning from the Court already indicates, this is a case built by Mr. Charleston based upon a couple of contracts. Actually, the first contract is the one that he says exists as a result of the student disciplinary procedure in the University of Illinois statutes.
But, you know, here's what worries me about your side of the case, Mr. Jedlow. Your brief really does not engage at all with what I understand to be the central point Mr. Charleston is making, which is that the discipline for the OBGYN problems had been imposed. He had accepted it. He was going to redo the rotation. He had the mentor. And then all of a sudden, out of left field, comes Hall, and he never knows. I mean, nobody ever tells him what Hall thinks he did wrong. One could imagine, you know, Hall saying unprofessional conduct could mean, you know, he was late to class too often, or unprofessional conduct could mean he shouted at people, or unprofessional conduct could mean he sexually harassed people, or, I mean, it could mean anything. And to kick him out of school against the backdrop of a fairly elaborate set of procedural protections that acknowledge that the school has been taking his tuition all these years in exchange for giving him a medical education is very troubling to me, actually. And that's why I started thinking of the class of one animus things, because, you know, somebody muttering in the background that you aren't going to be a good doctor, all of a sudden sabotaging your medical career is a ugly scenario.
Well, Your Honor, there are a couple main questions there. Let me first take up the question relating to this whole action from the, I have to look at the words here, the Urbana Student Progress and Promotion Committee action. That's the USPPC. That's actually the second contract that Charleston asserts is a foundation for his rights. And that really didn't come up until the reply brief. He says there that he had an agreement with the USPPC as to how this thing would be resolved. But he doesn't plead that, and I don't think it would be plausible for him to plead that he agreed with the faculty of the University of Illinois about how he would remediate. Things just don't work that way.
But see, you're still off target. The USPCC, I'm looking at page 4 of his brief, but I think everybody agrees with this much, recommends as sanctions that he be assigned a mentor, meet monthly, you know, do the rotation again. And as far as anybody knows, that's the end of it. Certainly as far as he knows, that's the end of it. And then all of a sudden this different group, the Urbana Executive Committee, enters the picture, because Paul writes to them, and somehow they also get the complaint that Kell and Wozniak have submitted. And it's a bad story. People kind of sneaking around behind somebody's back, not telling them what they did wrong.
Because, Your Honor, this is a 12B6 motion, we have to rely upon the allegations in the complaint.
Yeah.
And I think that's where Charleston fails. Because
I'm taking as he alleges that this is all done for no reason, that there's nothing behind it.
The USPPC, he pleads, only made a recommendation. And that would not be the basis for a contractual right.
Did you get to the UEC then?
Well, I think that what he's pleaded is a multiple-step process in which he did have notice and in which he did have the right to submit information.
I don't know, because what Judge Conlon says is, unbeknownst to Charleston, the complaint, his response letter, and a 2008 letter from James Hall were subsequently submitted to the Urbana Executive Committee. And I'm just looking at the district judge's opinion. And he wasn't told about it, and she goes on to say, this is page 3 of her opinion, Charleston was not permitted to challenge the allegations against him before the College of Medicine committee. So he never has a chance to say to Hall, what are you talking about? When did this happen? I mean, for all I know, it was solid grounds, but for all I know, it was not solid grounds.
Well, Your Honor, I look at the complaint, which is, I think, the foundation here. What Judge Conlon found is important, but the complaint is telling. And what the complaint says is that he had the opportunity to submit 3 different letters. In other words, he had 3 different hearings, because a hearing is nothing more than a right to be heard. He
what
must.
What paragraph are you talking about?
In the complaint?
Yes.
May I go get it, Your Honor?
Certainly. Because what I'm looking at is paragraph 23 and 24 of the complaint, particularly paragraph 24, which, as Judge Conlon correctly has said, alleges that the UEC disregarded the recommendation of USPCC, all without allowing him to defend himself, from the allegations. He tries to appeal, but again, he's not permitted to challenge. He's never given the information he needs to raise a challenge. That's what he's alleging.
Paragraph 20, Your Honor, says that he was permitted.
That's the USPC. You're not focusing on the Hall problem.
Well, he must have known about the Hall letter, Your Honor, because...
He says he didn't, though. Why should I take that fact contrary to his allegation?
Because he comes to this court and complains about it. Therefore, he must have known about it. It must have been a factor.
When? He says he doesn't find out about it until later. And I don't know what rule of law permits me to assume the contrary.
I think, Your Honor, that this is a multi-step process. He has conceded, Charleston has conceded, that the action of the USPC was only a recommendation. He's conceded that the action of the Urbana Executive Committee was only a recommendation.
He says at that point the matter was resolved. Paragraph 21, the USPCC recommended sanctions. Then he thinks it's resolved, so it's over. And then it's paragraph 22 that begins what turns out to be the fatal set of steps.
The other thing he pleads, though, Your Honor, is that the USPPC is only a recommendation. How he could have assumed that a recommendation resolved the matter from the university's perspective is hard to understand. It's not unusual for a multi-step process to have different kinds of recommendations, but none of them become binding until the final decision, which here was made by the College Committee on Student Progress.
So don't you think there's enough here to at least allow him a shot at repleting?
Well, I don't think that repleting... I think repleting would be futile here, Your Honor, and I think as the court's questioning of opposing counsel indicates, he still has not said anything about how he would replead to cure his multiple defects. I think one of the principal defects he has would have to cure is to be able to establish a property interest, which he cannot do.
Well, that's for the procedural due process aspect. That's not for the equal protection aspect.
The class of one?
Yeah.
Well, the standard on class of one is also very limited. According to this court in Flying J versus City of New Haven, he has to allege facts sufficient to overcome the presumption of rationality here.
Right. And animus, we've gone back and forth about whether that's essential, but it's... if you look at the various opinions in Del Marcel, I think it is sufficient. So what if he pleaded animus?
If he pleaded animus by whom? I suppose that he's saying now,
for the first time
today, he's saying, oh, well, we have this problem with Hall. Nobody's heard about that before.
Right. Well, that's the point.
And I think that the problem with the Hall thing is that he's arguing about animus that occurred in 2008. This is a 2010 decision by different people. Again, we get back to the question about whether he has a property interest here that's worthy of protection. And I don't believe that under this court's decision in Bissasor, he has come anywhere close to, nor could he ever come even close to pleading a property interest. I don't believe that under the class of one theory, he could even come close to establishing or alleging that there is no possible rational basis for this decision. The decision here has a clear rational basis, and that is to graduate competent, qualified graduate physicians. The College Committee, when it made its decision, and I see my time is up, is Your Honor.
Finish your thought.
The College Committee here had every right to consider all the facts in the file relating to this young man before they made a decision to terminate him. And that's what they did. This is nothing but...
So it's all right with you then for them to be secret facts that he doesn't know anything about.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that his pleading establishes that...
No, I'm asking you whether it's okay, hypothetically, if you will, for them to be secret facts that he doesn't know anything about.
Well, the way you ask the question, Your Honor, it makes it very difficult for me to answer in a way that would be contrary to what your question suggests. But I think that the complaint here asserts...
So in other words, you think secret facts are... probably not a good idea. Hypothetically. Forget about his case.
Hypothetically, perhaps. But again, every fact that relates to a student cannot be the subject matter of notice to the student. He's entitled to know about a process and be able to respond. This was an academic decision. His process rights are extremely limited. Thank you very much. The university defendants urge affirmation.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Bach?
Yes, Your Honor. I do not believe it's a far leap to make from the allegations that are pled in the complaint that during this process that suddenly a letter alleging misconduct from 3 years ago wasn't inspired by some sort of personal animus. I think that there's enough in the complaint, in the original complaint, that would lend itself to an amended complaint that this court
was allowed. What specifically would you point to then to come to the conclusion you want us on this animus?
I would point to the fact that because of the disagreement that took place between Dr. Hall and Mr. Charleston a few years prior led to Dr. Hall's actions in 2011 suddenly.
So where do we find that in the complaint?
Yes. I mean, it's alleged in the complaint that it was Dr. Hall that suddenly out of nowhere that sent this letter. Getting to the point.
But it would be new material. I mean, it's not anywhere in the existing complaint.
Well, it's in the existing complaint.
Well, Hall's letter is, but I mean, to follow up on what Judge Flom is saying, there's no hint in the existing complaint of Hall's motivation for sending this letter.
Just the fact that he's sending a letter three years after alleged misconduct.
But that also fails to suggest that the disagreement is irrational. For a class of one to go anywhere, if Hall has some reason for what he did.
Well, but we don't know what that reason
right.
is. You know, I mean, and that's why, of course, we're trying to get to discovery in this case to find out what exactly the allegations were and what his motivation, you know, what he's going to testify that his motivation was. But I certainly think it's reasonable and plausible to say that, you know, for him to suddenly make an allegation that he had never made before, never made any allegation against Charleston in the prior 3 years, that suddenly now he has this opportunity and he decided to take it. So I see my time is up.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.